The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
Whether we like to admit it or not, everyone lies, typically to benefit themselves in some way. But Carl is not like other people. His level of deceit goes so deep it's hard to characterize. He lives in an upside-down world where he can disappear and reappear, distorting all reality around him. Lies become truths, truths become lies. He takes pleasure in confusing people. From Levi's Eyes, A Son's Deadly Secret, and A Father's Cruel Betrayal, by Aphrodite Jones. Welcome to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. This is episode 88, A Python Spits Kerosene Upon the World, part 2 of Levi's Eyes, A Son's Deadly Secret and A Father's Cruel Betrayal by Aphrodite Jones. We are 3 weeks away from CrimeCon, and the anticipation is kicking up high. I'm looking forward to meeting many of you in Nashville, May 31st to June 2nd, 2024. Look for me on Podcast Row, and Aphrodite Jones will be at CrimeCon too. So make sure you've read her book or you buy her book, Levi's Eyes, and let's talk about it. My CrimeCon meetup will be in the Falls Bar Lounge on Friday night, May 31st at 11 p.m. I know it's late, but this is after the John Douglas event. Plenty of us will be coming there to hang out anyway. Before we kick in, I want to wish all the mothers out there a happy Mother's Day. Mom, you're appreciated. I thank you for everything. I love you and enjoy the day. Okay, now, recap of episode 87, which you kind of need to listen to before embarking on this one. We met Christina and Carl Carlson, living in Murphy's, California, with their 3 young children. Carl heroically rescues the kids from the house fire, but he is unable to save wife Christina, who dies of smoke inhalation trapped in the bathroom. The window in there was covered with plywood held in place by 17 nails. Suspicion arises with investigators finding evidence of a second pour of kerosene in the hallway where the fire ignited. An investigation ensued, but there was just not enough evidence to prove nefarious behavior, and the insurance company pays the claim of $200,000. Abruptly moving his family back to his hometown of Romulus, New York, Carl settles into single parenting, and then he meets Cindy Best, who falls for him as she comes to love his children, Aaron, Levi, and Katie. Carl and Cindy are married in a quiet ceremony and eventually enjoy a honeymoon cruise, while Christina's family continue to have serious questions about what happened the day she perished. Well, the honeymoon was over and reality kicked in. It was all on Cindy, juggling the kids, schedules, housework, waitressing, with Carl largely a bystander, taking her for granted. But the kids began calling her mom, which just thrilled her. Finding a lovely photograph of Christina, Cindy put it on the mantle so their mom was remembered always as part of the family. But Carl's constant comparing Cindy to Christina drove her nuts, making her feel inadequate. Challenging him, Carl insisted he wasn't doing that, with Cindy insisting that her feelings were hurt. 24 hours later, a downtrodden Aaron went to Cindy and promised not to talk about her mom anymore, with Cindy feeling a jolt. What on earth? Aaron told her that Daddy had said not to talk about Mommy. Cindy tried to explain, but Aaron was staring at the floor. Later, this triggered a huge fight with Carl. Cindy simply livid that he'd used her personal insecurities to manipulate Aaron that way. He said he'd speak to Aaron, but the damage had been done. Now age 10, Aaron began to pull away, stopped confiding in Cindy, and went on to become rebellious. The wedge Carl created would grow over time. A secret Cindy had carried into her new marriage was her alcoholism. Yeah. About a year into their marriage, Cindy bought a few bottles of wine, which kicked off a drinking jig. Carl, not a big drinker, thought she held her liquor well, not recognizing she had a serious problem. And a drunk Cindy was a more passionate Cindy in bed. In October 1994, Cindy was arrested for driving under the influence, terrified she'd lose her license. Carl was shocked, but supportive. But don't let this happen again. Carl spoke to his politically connected father, who lambasted Carl for bringing someone like this into the family. He needed to get control over his wife. This was a family embarrassment. His disapproval stung Carl badly. But this was back in the 1990s, when DUIs weren't taken as seriously as they are now, and Cindy was put on probation. But now, Carl used the DUI to chide and badger Cindy every chance he had. Well, Cindy joined AA, taking the vow of sobriety, with Carl callous and critical. And this caused Cindy to begin having second thoughts. Jumping into marriage was a mistake. He wasn't affectionate, and he demanded sex whenever the mood struck, and she resented this. His pitting the kids against her, forcing her to discipline them, didn't make it any better. The older they got, the more they resented Cindy, no matter how hard she tried. Never easy being a stepmother or a stepparent. Feeling trounced upon, Cindy wanted a child of her own. In vitro was expensive, but it also was successful, and she gave birth to a beautiful baby boy, Alexander Thomas Carlson, the miracle test tube baby. Bringing Alex home, Carl was involved with his new son, as were his sisters. Delighted, Levi became incredibly attached to his new brother. By 2001, Cindy and Carl brought a piece of the family farm from Junior, his dad, with a quaint country house upon it. These first years of Alex's life were idyllic, with Levi teaching Alex how to ride a tricycle and then a horse. But November 3rd, 2002, at 2 a.m. in the morning, Cindy heard Carl's shrill voice, quote, "Oh my God! Call 911. The barn is on fire," end quote. Jetting out of bed, Cindy saw the red glow in the dark sky, pulling on clothes and running out into the cold night air. Carl was trying to open the barn doors, but the heat drove him back as the second barn caught fire. In horror, they watched, waiting for the firefighters to arrive in near minutes, but it was too late to save the horses. All the bales of hay were kindling, driving the flames. Later, they'd removed the charred remains of Ginger, Buddy, and Star. Just a ghastly sight. Carl's parents, Junior and Alice, came to survey the damage and loss. Two colts, custom-made harnesses and bridles were irreplaceable, ranted Junior. Glaring daggers at Carl, he demanded to know what the hell had happened. Carl thought maybe he'd left the radio on? Junior glowered over the lost bridles, but Carl stopped him. They weren't in there. He had been cleaning out the barn, and he moved them to the shed. So another fire? Terrible luck Carl has, right? Terrible. Cindy tried to shield a devastated Alex from the loss of his favorite horse, but Carl loaded the carcass on a tractor, driving it right past the front of the house. In disbelief, Cindy would say, quote, "I saw Ginger's leg dangling out. That image is ingrained in my mind," end quote. Alex cried hard for his beloved pet, especially after Carl explained that she'd gotten cooked and the coyotes got her. Clearly Mr. Sensitivity. Filing a claim, the insurance adjuster said he needed to see all three dead horses himself, with a very annoyed Carl digging up what he could find. Two baby heads and a big mouth. The barn investigators also discovered, 3 weeks prior to the fire, Carl had increased the insurance on his barn from $20,000 to $60,000 and added two Belgian colts for $10,000 each. So right before another fire, Carl jacked up the insurance payout. Well, Wayne Insurance Company sent fire investigator William Ostrander to interview Carl. Carl said he discovered the fire looking out the bedroom window when he'd seen the red glow reflecting off the snow. Well, had he tried to rescue the horses? Yeah, but there was too much smoke when he pushed open one of the big sliding doors. Well, what was ginger used for? Carl replied, breeding and hayrides mostly. Had he updated the wiring in the main barn? Carl said he had not. And he suggested that the old cloth-covered wiring might have been a cause, or again, maybe it was the radio. Suspicion was raised, however, when Carl's brother and sister-in-law were interviewed and said that ginger was infertile and not worth a great deal of money. In the end, the point of origin was not established and the cause was deemed undetermined, and Wayne Insurance Company wrote a check for $115,000 to Carl, which he never mentioned to anyone, not even to Cindy. In the year before the barn fire, Levi Carlson had felt life becoming increasingly difficult. Now age 17, he was rebelling, adopting goth dress and smoking pot. The father-son arguments were intense. Every new tattoo or piercing brought a new round of acrimony. In an argument with Cindy, Levi locked his door, refusing to come out, then jumped from the second floor window, breaking his leg. Taking him to the ER, Cindy feared she was having a nervous breakdown. She had loved and cared for the kids for 10 years. Hadn't she proved herself? Sobbing, she asked herself why they didn't respect her. She'd saved her tips to take them to Disney World with no appreciation. And now Levi's behavior got worse. Cindy sought to get him into a program called PINS, Person in Need of Supervision, and set up an appointment. 2 days later, expecting someone from PINS to come calling, Cindy was greeted at the door by a Seneca County Sheriff deputy responding to a distress call from Levi Carlson. Jaw dropping, Cindy couldn't imagine why he'd made such a call. Levi spoke privately with the deputies, claiming his father was physically abusive to him, and Cindy knew and did nothing about it. Carl was, quote, hitting me in the head and ears, punching my shoulder and lower ribs, pushing me and slamming down, and he asked if I wanted to die. He said if I ever told lies about him again, that I wouldn't live through it, end quote. Well, CPS began investigating, with Carl denying he'd ever touched Levi. A social worker found discrepancies in Levi's statements because he had been adamant at Cindy witnessing all of this, but CPS found Cindy was in Canada when the event supposedly occurred. With nothing new reported after 6 months, Levi's allegations were deemed unfounded. Moving down the road, Levi went to live with Aunt Donna and Uncle Curtis, with the situation improving. By now, Aaron had left to join the Air Force, and then visited over Thanksgiving of that year, with Levi joining the family. There, Levi confronted Carl about the barn fire and the Murphy's fire, a huge fight erupting. In front of Alex, Cindy, and Aaron, Carl got Levi into a headlock, slamming him to the ground. Fists flying, Cindy managed to pull them apart. Running, Levi jumped into his car with Carl in pursuit. Back at Don and Curtis's place, Levi ran inside as Carl forced the door open, grabbing Levi and choking him. Curtis struggled to pull Carl away from him as Donna called 911 screaming for help. Only then did Carl relinquish the hold around Levi's throat. By the time the police arrived, Carl was gone. With no bruising around Levi's neck, he minimized. His father had tried to run him off the road. In January 2003, Levi met Cassie Rood, a 17-year-old fellow goth. Quickly smitten, Levi moved in with Cassie and her mom, far enough away from Carl for Levi to feel safe. Here, he was unconditionally accepted telling Cassie his parents didn't love him, that he'd been kicked out, was living in his car, and his father was a tyrant. Not thrilled with the black spiky clothes, Cindy saw that Cassie was well-mannered and clearly in love with Levi. But Carl didn't approve of any of it. Quote, "This creepy girl was encouraging Levi to become even more of an outcast," end quote. This was not the image the Carlsons wanted to project, and Levi would never find a job looking like that. Carl predicted money problems were not far off. Quote, "He'd done his best to help Levi with his emotional problems. He's done his best to coddle the kid through the years, and this was the thanks he got. Levi got himself tangled up with white trash," end quote. And then Cassie became pregnant, and they were getting married. Cindy managed to smile, with Carl snarling, quote, "I was pissed that her mother wanted to shout it out to the world and celebrate, because I knew there was nothing to celebrate. I knew they'd wind up getting a divorce," end quote. Well, Cindy urged them to wait, because they'd only known each other for a few months. But they were in love. They were having a kid. Just be happy, Levi urged. Cindy acquiesced, but thought they had a lot going against them, being teenagers, and Levi had just dropped out of high school. Katie and Aaron joined them to celebrate their wedding in October. And Alex, who was 8, didn't understand what a shotgun wedding was. He just adored his older brother. A year later, Cassie and Levi were doing well. He was working at a factory. Their daughter, Electra, was thriving, while it was cramped living in Cassie's mom, Terry's trailer. Levi learned he was eligible for a federal government HUD mortgage, and in July, he and Cassie bought a 100-year-old three-bedroom house on an acre of land in Clifton Springs. They painted over grease-covered kitchen walls, cleaned off decades of grime, and the house began to take shape. With good credit, they acquired modest rent-to-own furniture, including a bedroom set for Electra. But Levi refrained from telling his dad because he wanted to fix the place up first. Carl learned about the house from his brother, Mike. Incensed, Carl criticized the dump of a house, saying it should be torn down, and Levi was crushed. A year later, June 17th, 2005, at 2:30 a.m., a big glow, a big glow came from the direction of Levi's house. Fearing someone was inside the blazing fire, neighbor Clayton Keller broke a window, calling out. Too smoky, with no reply, he drove away to get help. By the time the fire trucks arrived, flames were bursting through the roof, and the house was a total loss. Levi was interviewed by fire investigator James Minute. He said he went to bed around 8:30 a.m., sleeping until 4:40 p.m. Cassie and her dad, Guy Getz, picked him up where they went to his in-law's place for dinner. Then Guy drove Levi to work, where he punched in at 10:53 p.m. Around 5 a.m., the police came and notified Levi about the fire. Thank God Cassie and Electra were spending the night at her mother's place because Cassie was pregnant and having some pains. Levi told Minute he carried $70,000 of insurance, which was required to get the HUD mortgage, and Levi wasn't sure if the smoke detectors had been working or not. Guys, this is a big no-no. If you didn't check last episode, please check your smoke detectors right now. This is critical. Lives are saved. And please check your carbon monoxide detector batteries, too. Fire investigator Jeff Harloff cleared debris from Levi's living room, examining the electrical service, and read an accelerant detector test. Wires on the north wall were fused with beading evident in the electrical box. Now, this is arcing damage, which usually shows at the point where the fire first attacked a live electrical current. Harloff noted that the charring was worst in the living room, with less in the dining room and kitchen areas, and the bedrooms were largely intact. There were some concerning observations, however. The sheets and blankets had been removed from the mattresses, and a large dresser had been emptied, as well as the closets. That is very weird, right? I mean, who does that? Harloff then discovered another Carlson fire at the barn in 2002, which had been ruled an accident. Well, a month later, a 7-page report listed Levi's fire as accidental in nature and the ignition source undetermined. Levi and Cassie would receive a check for $110,000, using $70,000 to pay off the mortgage. Well, after Levi's fire, the tension between the families mounted. Carl figured that the kids would use the remaining $40,000 to rebuild their lives. But instead, they moved in with Cassie's mom, Terry, infuriating Carl. When Ivy Phoenix Carlson was born October 21, 2005, she did not meet her Carlson grandparents for over 6 months. A full year later, Cassie permitted Cindy to babysit, but that was only because she needed a break from her two small toddlers. With Katie now at college, only Alex, now 12, was still at home. Cindy spoiled Electra and Ivy, always having milk and cookies ready, entertaining them with horses and peacocks. Before Ivy was 2, Levi told Carl that Cassie was considering divorcing him. He'd lost his job, and they had money problems. Well, wait. What happened to the $40,000? Well, Levi had gotten a Datsun 280Z and loaned his friend some money, with Carl roaring, quote, "What were you thinking? You're a father now. You should be putting your kids first," end quote. He said while he and Cindy would continue to spoil the girls, Cassie and Levi were on their own. But truth was, Carl took pleasure in his son's crumbling life. And divorce soon came, and Levi was living in a heatless trailer with Carl disgusted enough to buy him a space heater. Levi did earn his GED because getting a job was really hard without one, which is a fact. Cassie was also keeping the girls from him, with Carl unsympathetic. Carl explained, quote, "Look, we've all been young and stupid. In your case, I guess the barrel's going to have to fall on you, hit you in the head, because that's the only way you'll ever learn," end quote. But Carl did offer, "Come help out at the farm on the weekends, and we'll help get you through this rough patch." And quickly, Levi became a fixture at the farm. And then Alex came running from the back barn. Wait for it. There was a fire. Levi's Datsun 280Z was smoking up in the garage. Levi tried to save it, but the interior was gone. Carl mused that it was probably an electrical short. Levi just couldn't catch a break. Had he inherited his dad's bad luck? And let's see, how many fires is that? Carl's Dodge Charger, Murphy's that killed Christina, the barn, Levi's house, Levi's car. Gosh, just terrible luck. Well, Cassie wound up being awarded full custody of Electra and Ivy. Deemed unstable, Levi could only see the girls during supervised visitation at his parents' farm. Carl advised him to fix his life. Be a good dad, get steady work, and improve your living conditions, and he would get the girls back. Levi fell into a deep depression. Carl offered to get him a job interview at Guardian Glass, but the piercings and all that, it had to go. Levi resisted, but Carl fumed, quote, "Look, working with a furnace running at 3,000 degrees, the earrings are going to melt right out of your ears," end quote. Acquiescing finally, Levi started work at Guardian Glass in early 2008, getting a great salary and benefits. Levi handled robotic machines, loading large sheets of glass into trucks, and he was really good at it. He bought a used truck, he found a decent apartment in Seneca Falls, and his life was on the upswing. Good for Levi. Levi, Alex, and Cindy enjoyed his visitation with Ivy and Electra. Horses, homemade cookies, playing dress-up, the girls had a blast. Carl and Levi were also mending their broken relationship, bonding like never before. Carl was proud of his son, treating him like an equal. At work, Levi had spotted an imperfection in some glass sheets, saving the company millions of dollars, with Levi awarded a significant bonus. But Levi was still Levi, and he blew through the bonus money on his old group of friends. Carl warned him he was hanging around with losers who saw him as a sucker. Not long afterward, Levi's apartment was condemned after a fire. I know, another fire, yes. After a fire damaged a corner unit and was probably caused by a careless cigarette smoker. Well, now 23 years old, after groveling, Cindy and Carl agreed that Levi could live with them for a little while, but he would turn his paycheck over to Cindy, who would budget for him. He wouldn't pay rent, but he would do chores. And Cindy helped Levi save a substantial amount of money to begin again, while he and Carl became closer, more like friends. Carl also had Levi take advantage of some perks from working at Guardian Glass. You could meet with financial advisors, set up 401ks or annuity plans, and get insurance. And Levi could use these to prove he was capable of taking care of his children and their futures should, God forbid, something happen to him. That November of 2008 was bitterly cold, and Carl approached Levi about working on his truck. Levi readily agreed, happy to help. But first, he and Carl swung by the bank to have some documents witnessed and notarized. With Carl and Cindy heading out to her aunt's funeral, Carl took Levi out to the barn to show him what needed to be done. Running late, Carl told Cindy to wait in the car. He'd be back really quick. Returning wearing a pressed white shirt, sports jacket, Carl approached the car, motioning to Cindy, and ran back in the barn to tell Levi they were leaving. Returning, they set off for the funeral. Driving along, Carl noticed a spot on his shirt and insisted making a stop at Walmart to pick up a new one, aggravating Cindy. But they still managed to arrive at the funeral on time. The deceased, Aunt Alice, was beloved by all and had always treated Carl with respect. But Carl went into his really poor jokester mode, poking fun at everyone's expense, making everybody uncomfortable, with Carl relishing being the center of attention. Emotionally drained, Cindy gestured that it was time to leave. Back home at the farm around 4 p.m., they were surprised to see Levi's truck still parked out front. He should have finished up hours ago. Well, Cindy went in to let the dogs out, with Carl going to see what Levi was up to. Then, banging on the glass, Carl screaming for Cindy to call 911. The truck had fallen on top of Levi. He was pinned. Carl shouted, quote, "He's already stiff. He's been under there for a while," end quote. Cindy would later say, quote, "I couldn't let myself think he was dead. I just couldn't believe it," end quote. Neighbor and firefighter Mike Pisalqua heard the 911 call on his scanner and raced over to the Carlsons. Carl was screaming Levi's name, and Mike saw that he was beyond help, with Carl falling to the ground, rolling in the dirt, screaming, quote, "Oh my God, his fucking chest is crushed. He's not breathing," end quote. EMTs removed Levi's body into the ambulance. 23-year-old Levi Holder Carlson was pronounced dead on arrival at Geneva General Hospital. He'd suffered, quote, "massive chest and abdominal trauma," end quote, from the accident, his life taken when he was just getting it back on track. Coroner Dr. Jason Feinberg would certify the cause of death was, quote, "a truck falling off a jack," end quote. The jack had been insufficient to hold up a farm truck. Young Alex was destroyed by his older brother's death. Carl's brothers arrived to console him, tears welling up. They learned that Levi wanted to donate his organs, with Carl blustering in dissent as the team removed Levi's corneas. They were transplanted into a 14-year-old girl who was partially blind, and she wrote a note to the family thanking Levi for the miracle of sight. Calls went out to Cassie's mother, Terry, to Aaron, who was stationed in Georgia, to Katie, who is now a Harriman State Park police officer. Erin called Aunt Colette, who was just stricken, making arrangements for Art and Arlene to fly in. No one could believe Levi was gone. Art could only think, quote, "It was happening all over again," end quote. Losing Levi brought out another side in Carl. He was devastated, garnering sympathy from everyone as he thrived on the attention. He gave keepsakes away, like Levi's favorite baseball cap and guitar went to Alex. A book of original poetry he gave to Katie, hoping it would soothe her grief. Carl was magnificent as the grieving father, with Cindy, Alex, Erin, and Katie all heartbroken. None imagined that anything was amiss or that their father had an agenda. But Carl did, quote, "He was elated. For him, Levi's death was a means to an end. Very soon, Levi would become solid gold," end quote. Quote, "I, Levi Carlson, leave Carl Carlson as a power of attorney and executor of my will. I leave all my assets to Carl Carlson to distribute as he wishes to my daughters, Electra and Ivy Carlson. My wishes are not to remain on any life support and that my organs are to be donated. I would like to be cremated and my ashes to be buried as my parents see it." Levi Carlson, signed and stamped by Notary Public Michael Scaglione, end quote. This was the document that Carl and Levi notarized at the bank the very day he died, on November 20th, 2008. Planning the funeral, Cindy set up the church and selected an urn for Levi's ashes. Cindy later placed Levi's ashes on the mantle in their living room. Carl notified Guardian Glass. All employees carried a $15,000 life insurance policy. He needed the cash to pay for flowers, the funeral, the minister, and the like. The wake was packed with standing room only, the whole town affected by the tragic death of such a young man. Colette and Grandma Arlene arrived without Art. Dismayed, Cindy couldn't understand it, as Art and Levi had a good relationship. Levi had visited him more than once over the years. But Cindy was coping the best she could with the crowd of people, family, her co-workers, Levi's friends, his financial planner, friends from elementary school, who were just stricken, everybody simply in shock. Levi had touched so many people. The funeral was held at the Presbyterian Church, and unfortunately, drama occurred between Cassie and Cindy. Cassie had sent a flower arrangement with a sash saying, "Beloved Father," but she also wanted to include another that read, "Loving Husband." Huh. Well, Levi and Cassie's relationship had been tense and unpleasant until literally his last day on earth, and Cindy refused Cassie's request. Fortunately, Electra and Ivy, at 5 and 3 years old, didn't really understand what was happening. Uncle Mike gave the eulogy, mentioning Levi's fierce love for his girls, that he had matured into a fine young man who loved that baseball cap and Mountain Dew. Cindy hosted the visitors, including Colette and Arlene, with gifts of cold-cut platters, homemade baked pies, and other foodstuffs, making for a decent meal. The women hung out in the kitchen reminiscing. To Cindy, Arlene seemed flighty, focusing more on the ministers, while Colette shared stories from Murphy's and the time the kids had come out for a two-week visit. Cindy was invited to come out to California for a girls' trip, but sadly, this never materialized. Over the years before Levi's death, Erin and Colette had grown closer, even as her relationship with Cindy grew more brittle. Cindy came to believe that Colette might be contributing to their difficulties. But Erin began to open up to Colette, talking about her memories of the fire, with puzzle pieces falling into place. In the weeks after the funeral, Carl became increasingly irrational, depressed, and angry, saying it was a freak accident, blaming himself. One day, Carl came in with a letter informing a very surprised Cindy that Levi had a life insurance policy with New York Life for $300,000. "Levi?" Levi had hardly been a forward-thinking planner. Cindy wondered, will the girls get the money? Would it be put into a trust? And Carl said he would find out. Returning home, Carl informed Cindy that he was the sole beneficiary because Levi didn't trust Cassie to do what was right for the girls. Later, they learned that Levi also had an accident rider on his insurance policy in the amount of $400,000. All right, that's $700,000 in insurance. Carl said that everyone working at Guardian Glass had a rider in case of an accident because it only cost a few more dollars a month. And Carl berated himself, adding that Cassie should never find out about this money. She would fight tooth and nails to get her hand on it. And knowing Cassie, Cindy had to agree. By Christmas, Carl was upset that visitors had stopped coming and that he was no longer the center of the universe. Cindy soothed him, saying that people didn't bring up Levi to avoid making them sad. Prepping for the holidays, Cindy put a Mountain Dew under the tree, a token gift meaning that Levi was still with them. January 2009, Carl learned that New York Life was investigating the claim, calling agent Tony Crissy. Crissy explained that the company had a legal right to deny the claim, with Carl flipping out, insisting the policy was active. Tony assured them that after the investigation was done, Carl would likely be paid. Carl groused, investigation? Investigation for what? There is nothing to investigate. But doing a cursory dive, Carl received a check for $707,000. In the company newsletter, Crissy would brag that a loving grandfather had reinvested the money in New York Life, providing a, quote, gift of love, end quote, for his two granddaughters. On July 22, 2009, Cindy and Carl went to Tony Crissy's office, signing a dozen documents. All in all, Carl invested $607,000 with New York Life in 8 separate annuity accounts, annuities for Electra, Ivy, for Carl and Cindy, for Carl alone, 2 10-year fixed annuities for Electra and Ivy, and Cindy never noticed the missing $100,000. Assured that the money could not be touched, truth was it could be surrendered with penalties, something Cindy did not know. Buried in the pile of documentation were whole life insurance policies on Electra and Ivy for $300,000. Carl claimed that these were investments for the girls. If one girl died, the money went to the other. It was 2 years later that Cindy began to ask herself some serious questions about the day Levi died. Carl stopping to buy the new shirt at Walmart, and country music was playing in the barn that day. Levi hated country music. Yeah, country and goth does not blend. Sorry, it just doesn't. She whispered to the ether, had Carl done something? And then Cindy chided herself for even considering that. But all that life insurance. Doubt gnawed on her. Snooping through Carl's papers, she found Tony Crissy's article, which said that Carl took Levi to Tony and that getting the insurance was not Levi's idea. Now, Carl denied this. But then Cindy asked, had Levi died before he could take the medical exam? Well, yeah, Levi had blown off the appointment. Well, Cindy asked, quote, what would have happened if Levi didn't pass it? He might have failed it because he had those throat issues and he was a big smoker, end quote. Carl dismissed this, insisting that the exam was a formality and that everybody passed it. But the truth was, Levi suffered from achalasia, a rare disorder that makes it difficult for food and liquid to pass from the esophagus, which connects the mouth and stomach. His throat would close up, making it difficult to swallow. Cindy later learned that this condition would have sent up red flags on the policy, and Levi died the day before the physical. Now she began to analyze the other mishaps that had plagued Carl. Their dog, Maddie, being caught under Carl's tractor wheels. Alex's favorite dog, Banjo, followed Carl into the garage and died. 3 of their peacocks went missing, with Carl finding them dead. and then Carl's weird, over-the-top behavior at the hospital when Levi died, the hysteria, the nurses pulling him off Levi when they came to take his corneas for donation. It made no sense. Then she began thinking about the house fire that killed Christina. Had Carl left her there to die? What about the barn fire killing their beloved Ginger and the other horses? Carl had been so blasé about it. The pieces of the puzzle began coming together, and Cindy fell off the wagon again, gutted by these thoughts overwhelming her. And Carl, he brought her home bottles of alcohol to consume. By now, Carl was permanently disabled due to his chronic back pain after a surgery to correct the problem. Still managing to work with the horses, he'd whine that he was still hurting, blaming the incompetent surgeon. Swallowing handfuls of Vicodin and getting sympathy, Carl thrived on the melodrama. He had totally convinced Alex he needed another surgery, while Cindy believed he was faking it. I agree with Cindy, in case you're wondering. Now, Cindy was now in her 40s and was struggling to see when driving. Going for a consult, she learned her eyelids were sagging and was referred to a plastic surgeon. Since this was necessary, insurance would cover the procedure, but why not have a facelift? It would only cost an additional $8,000. Carl was all for it, and now Cindy was highly conscious of her drooping skin at her jawline. Yet once you see, you can't unsee, right? So Carl assured her they could borrow it from the interest that had accrued on the annuities and then pay it back fairly quickly. So Cindy went for it, and the facelift was a huge success, with her looking 10 years younger. Carl now showered her with affection, something that had been lacking for years, and seemed his old self, out of pain and joking around. With this fresh start, Cindy smothered her crazy, suspicious thoughts about Carl, and she had high hopes for the future. Carl came to Cindy with a business idea. He had seen an ad in an agricultural flyer that a food broker from New York City was looking for duck farmers. Well, Carl wanted to give it a go. Well, ducks? What did Carl know about ducks? But he was like a dog with a bone when he got an idea into his head. After badgering Cindy, assuring her it would cost $15,000 at the most to get up and going, she agreed, co-signing a loan from the annuity. And he'd pay back every dime. Reflecting back, Cindy said she told Carl, quote, "It would only be that one time I told him I didn't want any part of it," end quote. But Carl had broken the dam when they borrowed for her facelift, and now it would be easy to do it again and again and again. By spring 2011, Carl's duck business was thriving, and he expanded in June, ordering ducklings by the hundreds every month. Asking for Cindy's help, they adopted the name C&K Farms. He was receiving regular checks from the food broker, and he had made a sweetheart deal with some Amish farmers, and the Manhattan upscale restaurants had never had such delectable gourmet duck breasts. By August, Carl expanded yet again, now ordering thousands of ducklings every month. Way too fast, Carl. And guess what? Soon the business began to lose money. Carl complained that the food broker just wasn't paying him his fair due. He told Cindy he'd managed to turn the cash flow around, and Cindy would discover he had taken out a $12,000 line of credit against their house to make the business appear to be in the green. When that was gone, he told Cindy he wanted to borrow more money from the annuities. From handling the books, Cindy knew that they were in trouble, owing a lot of money. Balking that he'd gotten too big too fast, Carl pleaded that they had no choice. He just needed her to co-sign a loan of $15,000. And that decision to get the facelift came back to bite her in the ass. Now, for Alex's 16th birthday, he wanted to go visit Aaron in San Francisco. Traveling on his own, Alex saw sights he'd never seen before, and he would come to see his sister Erin through older eyes. Erin felt it was time to share a few things with her little brother. She loved him so very much but have reasons for keeping her distance from the family, namely their father. Aaron warned, quote, "One day he's going to turn on you for no reason because he's got a split personality and he can be sadistic. The day will come when you're going to see it," end quote. She revealed that she left home after he threatened her, and Alex declared she was full of it. Aaron insisted she was telling the truth. She was the one who'd seen him beat up Levi, that Child Protective Services had investigated. Alex called her a liar, but Aaron persisted. After her mother's death, quote, "One time he picked me up by my neck and slammed me up against the wall. He was choking me. I couldn't breathe, and he wouldn't let me down until I said uncle," end quote. Oh, and Dad, he hated Levi. With this weird grin on his face, she'd seen him hit Levi with a broomstick, and he looked like he enjoyed doing it. Alex rejected all of this. Aaron always exaggerated, but this was way too much, even for her. Now, she made Alex promise, do not go home and talk about what she said, giving him a fierce bear hug. All the way back to Romulus, Alex mulled this over. Aaron, she had to be crazy. And a break came for Carl and Cindy. A producer from the Canadian Food Network called about featuring C&K Farm on a show, pitching in. Carl was elated. Cindy was excited. Motivated, Carl enlisted help from his Amish partners in spiffing up the place, cleaning out the duck silos, and putting in new fencing so it looked like they were free-range ducks. Cindy planted beautiful yellow mums, truly happy for Carl. Filmed, Cindy and Alex were on screen with Carl, who was devoted to, quote, giving his ducks the best life possible, end quote. So, Murder Bookies, I found this episode of Pitchin' In, Season 3, Episode 10, on Freevee. I also have a link to it on Prime in my blog. You want to see this. You really do. Watching this, seeing Carl, Cindy, Alex, the host Lynn, and their interactions, which is totally apart from this true crime story context, but seeing C&K Farms itself, holy moly. At the conclusion of the episode, Carl says, quote, "I feel privileged that someone has recognized that I've been trying to make a better duck naturally and doing something that no one else is doing," end quote. So it's still all about Carl. Aphrodite Jones writes that Carl's ego blew up and he anticipated a huge boom in business. But as they settled back into normalcy, once again, Carl was obsessed with the ducks, ignoring Alex and Cindy. Quote, "He showered the ducks with love and attention right up to the moment he sent them off to be slaughtered," end quote. With Carl's endless gloating, Cindy again began reconsidering what had happened to Levi. Carl pranced around using Levi's money and never paid it back. The annuities had become his personal piggy bank, taking loan after loan, with the duck farm hinged on a success that was so close, so close. He didn't care about his granddaughters. He never even bought them a birthday present. As Cindy considered, her thoughts grew darker and festered in her mind. Calling her sister Bev, Cindy confessed she didn't trust Carl anymore. She'd been looking at the annuity paperwork, trying to make sense of it, and then she had caught Carl burning documents. Worse, she gave her fear voice. Cindy feared that Carl had done something to Levi that day, that he killed Levi for the insurance money, money that should belong to Electra and Ivy. Well, Bev thought she was crazy, and Cindy had started drinking again, and she wasn't sure she could stay with Carl. Should she hire a private investigator? Would he kill Alex to get back at her? She was truly frightened of Carl and what could happen. And when Bev's husband got home that night, she told him Cindy was losing it and drinking again. Cindy hired PI Steve Brown in the fall of 2011. She was anxious and worried about confidentiality, clearly shaking. She revealed the layers of her suspicions that had accumulated over the years. The barn fire in 2002, the fatal California house fire before that, the accidental death of Levi, subsequently collecting $700,000 in insurance money, and how it went to Carl and not the girls. She also handed over a manila file of documents on the New York Life annuity accounts for Steve to review. 2 days later, Cindy and Steve met again. He explained that the annuities came with significant death benefits. Cindy was potentially worth over $1 million to her husband, dead, with Cindy's jaw dropping in shock. And there were two life insurance policies, on Electra and Ivy, with Cindy the sole beneficiary. Well, Cindy didn't believe it, but it was all true. Quote, Steve told her, I think you're safe as long as you play it cool, because if your husband was planning to do something to you, it would have already happened. But Cindy wasn't so sure, and she was petrified. End quote. He thinks she's safe if she plays it cool. Oh God, that's terrifying. Now fearful of talking on the phone, Cindy created a new email address, which was safer. Emailing Bev on October 1st, 2001, she filled her in on the PI and Carl making the kids watch the Christmas tree burn back in 1991. That afternoon, Bev replied, recommending that Cindy make copies of any paper she had and keeping them in a safe place. 2 days later, Cindy emailed Bev. She'd forgotten to tell the PI that the night of the barn fire, Carl had gone downstairs. At the time, she thought he was sneaking ice cream, while Carl claimed he had gone to the bathroom. And minutes later, he was screaming about the barn being on fire. Bev replied to Cindy. Well, this was news to her. Cindy had never mentioned Carl going downstairs that night before. Could she find copies of the barn insurance? How much money did he get from that fire? And added, quote, is there any way you can ask Carl to take a lie detector test? End quote. Bev, I don't think that is a good idea because she's safe if she plays it cool, and that would not be cool. October 4th, 2011, Cindy replied to Bev. She'd asked Carl for a divorce. She'd been drinking, and she told Carl that she wanted to get Alex grown so she could commit suicide. Quote, but believe me, I am not suicidal. I could never, ever do that to Alex. That was the drinking talking. End quote. Same day, Bev replies to Cindy, make certain you delete these emails. Carl cannot know that you suspect anything. Bev had also begun reading up on psychopaths, and she recognized some of these traits in Carl. Cindy should Google it. Well, Cindy did Google sociopath, shaking in her chair. She was blown away seeing the telltale signs that described Carl to a T. Quote, constant lying and manipulation, not respecting the feelings of others, difficulty recognizing emotion, grandiose sense of self, overstepping boundaries, no regard for negative consequences. Cindy still didn't want to believe it, but she knew Carl was lying. End quote. All right, so I need to point this out. The latest research on psychopaths and sociopaths, they have many overlapping traits. But in the most general terms, sociopaths are products of the environment, nurture, severe child abuse, shaming, trauma, where psychopaths are born with specific differences in brain structure, certain aggressive genes, with environment playing a role in triggering subsequent negative behavior. A lot of research is currently being done in neuropsychology, so stay tuned. I do think Bev is spot on, and that Carl is a psychopath, in my opinion. Weeks passed. Cindy called her PI. She was afraid the business was going under, and what was Carl plotting? Did he know that she'd gone through his papers? Because she went to make copies of the New York Life papers, and the manila envelope was gone. He knew. She just knew he knew. Steve told her to not jump to conclusions, as Cindy confided she had begun sleeping with scissors under her bed. He reassured her. Carl would not do anything if he could get caught and she was safe at home. But Cindy knew he could create an accident, and now she was shut out of the C&K farm accounts. She needed him to find out what Carl was hiding. Steve suggested that he pose as a marketing consultant, but he'd need Cindy to set up a meeting, and Steve would do the rest. So Cindy told Carl she found someone on Google that might help the business by developing a good marketing strategy. And, acting impulsively, Carl had Cindy set it up. Steve arrived with pamphlets on USDA marketing strategies, making suggestions about ads, and as predicted, Carl talked a lot about himself. Quickly, Steve gained Carl's confidence, later saying that Carl was, quote, the nicest guy in the world. His eyes, his mannerisms, he was very charming, end quote. He also quickly showed his dark side, furious when Cindy wouldn't co-sign any more loans. In November, Carl invited Steve to invest in his duck business, and the men went on a tour of a huge poultry plant. This utterly grossed Steve out. The stench of dead bird carcasses mingled with the scent of blood and manure was revolting. Carl, however, he was nonchalant, seeming to like the electric stun guns that knocked the birds out before their throats were slit. Steve asked if Carl used the stun guns at the farm. Nah, he did it the old-fashioned way, grabbing Steve by the neck, yanking it back, and making slashing motions across his throat, with Carl grinning, relishing the environment. Driving back, Carl pontificated. It would cost $1 million to open a USDA plant, which was totally undoable. But he could easily build a smaller poultry production plant if Cindy started to cooperate because she, quote, had become too much of a problem. She was a roadblock that Carl needed to get out of his way, end quote. Steve reported back to Cindy. Carl's grandiose plans had failed. He was acting weird, losing money, and couldn't afford to keep going. Carl had complained, quote, I have all these ducks running around on the farm, thousands of them, that I couldn't sell because they weren't big enough, end quote. Steve advised Cindy, quote, I think you need to cash out some of those accounts. You should make up an excuse and tell Carl you've changed your mind. Wait, Cindy clarified, you think I should just close everything? Yes, he said, and keep your granddaughters away from him, end quote. That night, Cindy approached Carl. She'd agreed to co-sign and cash out the bulk of the annuities, but she insisted they split the money 50-50. Quote, this way you'll have plenty of cash for your ducks, and I can invest my half in something else, end quote. Carl's eyes lit up. After paying penalties, they had $200,000 to split. Now Steve advised Cindy to invest in real estate, and he had a client who was looking to flip a nice little house that already had renters. If she needed cash, the owner could sell it back to her, perhaps at a small loss, but it would protect the cash from Carl. January 15th, 2012. Cindy told Carl she wanted a trial separation, and he acted totally devastated. He gagged, splashed water on his eyes, making it look like he was crying. He agreed that they were fighting way too much. Teenage Alex was angry as anticipated, but Cindy found a rental house about 5 miles from the farm, and Carl encouraged her to take any stuff she wanted. He'd even help her move. The day came, but Carl claimed to have slipped on the ice, his arm in a sling. He wouldn't be able to help out. But he hoped the separation would make the marriage stronger, as he immediately began to manipulate Alex, putting a wedge between him and his mom. Nevertheless, Alex agreed to split the time with his parents and confided in Katie that his mom was drinking, slurring, stumbling, and he couldn't bring anyone home. He was so embarrassed. Then Carl went to the diner where Cindy worked, sharing his concern over her, quote, severe drinking problem, end quote. Carl was undermining Cindy, trying to get her fired so she couldn't support herself. Cindy drunk dialed her cousin Jackie, spilling her fears, including that Carl had killed Christina, rambling about insurance policies, her being forced to co-sign loans, with Jackie listening, but she thought Cindy was delusional. But as she shared what was new information with her, Jackie saw the pattern. All the serious accidents peppered throughout Carl's life, Jackie swore she'd keep all this a secret, and then she actually did not do so. Steve continued to work on the Levi and now Christina Carlson cases, but he needed input from Christina's family. In February, Cindy emailed Christina's sister, Colette, and Cindy told her a PI from California had contacted her asking questions about Christina, keeping it casual and friendly. Had Christina had any plans to leave Carl? A few hours later, Colette responded that she had received no inquiries. Who was this PI and what was his number? And she had alluded to a few things when Cindy and Carl first got together, and Cindy had not been receptive. That afternoon, Cindy replied that she did not recall Colette's suspicions, but it had taken Cindy years to realize how deceptive Carl was. She apologized, saying she thought Colette was grieving at the time. And darn, she hadn't gotten the PI's name, but he was a student looking into a cold case. And if there was injustice, perhaps it wasn't too late. That evening, Colette replied. It was odd Cindy had been contacted about something she had no firsthand knowledge about, and then Colette threw down. Call the phone company and get the PI's number. She added, quote, "If you're fishing, your fishing expedition with me is done. You know Carl better than I do. Make your best judgment. Katie's a cop. You should ask her for guidance," end quote. The final email came from Cindy, who said she wasn't just stirring up trouble for Carl. Didn't Colette want justice? And added that she would not email her again. And this is where I will pause episode 88. A great python spits kerosene upon the world. Levi's Eyes by Aphrodite Jones, part 2. And in 2 weeks, we will delve into episode 89, Prior Bad Acts, second cast, where it begins to appear that justice may happen for Levi and Christina too. And again, I thought I knew this story, but believe me, I did not. So you need to read this book. So who doesn't love horses? The Kentucky Derby was just last Saturday, and we are into Triple Crown racing season. My next amazing true crime book is Broken, The Suspicious Death of Ali Dar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age by animal law attorney Fred Cray. I met Fred at CrimeCon 2023, and the story he told me so impressed me, I had to cover this story, and my Patreon murder bookies concurred. It was a cool, quiet evening at Calumet Farm, where many valuable racehorses, including the prolific champion stallion, Ali Dar, had settled into their stalls for the evening. While nothing seemed out of the ordinary, that was not the case. A grievously injured horse was discovered, cause unknown, which jump-started one of the biggest mysteries to ever hit horse racing. And author Fred M. Cray peels back the onion layers, revealing shocking testimony and key evidence that leads to the truth about the death of a magnificent racehorse, Ali Dar. I recall Ali Dar. I was practically raised at Monmouth Park Racetrack in New Jersey, so this story really strikes me close to the heart. Thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. I need you to be proactive here and leave me an awesome review that will help make new murder bookies. And share this podcast with your friends. See if they'd love to listen to. Share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com, on Twitter or Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, or join Patreon for $4 a month. I have new designs out on Spreadshop, so get your merch, and the links are on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com with all my sources, photographs, show notes, our snack recipe, and wine pairing. Always trust your gut and lock your doors and windows. Written and produced by Jill. All rights reserved.